This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Cool Projects Show. I am your host, Michelle Molyneux, and we'll be covering various projects, whether it's car restoration, construction, heritage restoration, or like today, we're going to be talking about art. If you have a project from anywhere around the world, we want to hear about it. This is a place where you can actually showcase your project and share your experiences with you. This morning, we're going to be talking to Lolita Hamel, an internationally acclaimed artist, educator, writer, and public speaker. Lita, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we talk about your passion for art and your art projects, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. I'll start with the unusual thing that, I mean, most artists, when you talk to them, say they knew when they were a kid that they wanted to be an artist. If you had told me 15 years ago that I was going to become a professional artist, I probably wouldn't have believed you, because my track was very, very different. But I'll go back a little bit because it is relevant. I grew up in a small town in northern BC here in Canada. And I did all kinds of things that kids usually do, and I did competitive swimming and piano and choir and outdoors and academics. And I went on, I was a lifeguard and swimming instructor, so I started teaching at a young age. I was 15 when I started. And I went on to university and did an honors degree in philosophy and English at the University of Victoria, and that was, I graduated 20 years ago. And I thought at that point I was going to become a philosophy professor. A wide variety of things caused me to decide to not do that. But while I was doing my philosophy degree, I remember reading the works of, you know, Plato and Aristotle and Nietzsche, and I don't know how familiar people are with the works. I'll get into why this is relevant. And I remember while I was reading everything, these incredible visual pictures coming into my mind, like especially Plato's cave. It was so visual for me. And I thought, oh, I'm going to go find some paintings or some images or something to kind of go with all the writing, because anybody who's read philosophy knows that it can be really dense and really thick, like tough to get through sometimes. You know, especially Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and stuff. And so when I went and started trying to find images, there were like a handful. There were barely any at all. And I thought, I remember thinking to myself, boy, somebody really should paint these. And little did I know at that time that that person would be me. But I went on my way. And then the last year of my philosophy degree, I ended up being stuck in a snowstorm. There was this incredible snowstorm in 1996 in Victoria where literally overnight the city came to a standstill. And so I had gone out with a friend of mine named Sandy, and I woke up the next morning and called for a cab to get a ride home. This is when I was still in my early 20s. And the people on the other end just laughed at me, and they said, "Have you looked outside?" And 5 feet of snow had fallen overnight. So the snow was going up over the cars. I couldn't go anywhere, and I ended up being stuck at her house for 3 days. I hadn't brought anything with me, hadn't planned to do anything there. To this day, I don't know why, but I grabbed a book off her shelf that was of black and white images of Venice, and I sat down and I started to draw. And 6 hours passed by, and it felt like 1 hour. And I remember looking at it and going, wow, that actually kind of looks like that. Didn't think much of it. Started to just take some drawing classes for fun, and I studied with Gwen Howarth in Victoria. And I drew for about 6 years, just because I enjoyed it. And time vanished, and it was a fun hobby. And while I was doing that, I had some opportunities for a career lifeguarding again and teaching, and I eventually worked my way up into being the aquatics manager of a $17 million rec center in Surrey. And while I was there, I started attending the Vancouver Academy of Art, which is, it was in Vancouver. It's since closed, but The teachers there were classically trained instructors, so many of them from the Florence Academy of Art. So I received some very formal classical training, and I got married. We had a daughter, and everything seemed all set, and that was 15 years ago. So my life was all sort of packaged up. As it seemed, and
so how did that? How does the art fit into all of this? Now that you've had this set lifestyle for yourself,
yeah. Well, by that point, the art was a hobby, and then when our daughter was a year and a half old, my husband and daughter and I were in a car accident. And my husband got very injured. It wasn't clear at the time that he was very injured. It was gradual onset. And, you know, they kept saying it's a concussion. He was suffering from pain all the time. He looked like he was 90 years old, and he was the color of death. Like, that's how I describe it, that gray-green sort of color. And, no, the experts couldn't figure out what was going on. And, anyway, that itself is quite a long story, but What the result of that was, I needed to really look at my life, and you know, the rug basically got ripped out from underneath us. So financially, because Patrick couldn't work, I had just been on maternity leave, I had some big decisions to make, and some of them were practical and some of them were, you know, spiritual. Like, why am I here? What do I want to do with my life? I really started asking myself these really important questions, and I remembered deep inside myself, it was quite buried, but I remembered that whole someone should really paint these, and I knew this was a calling for me. I didn't know why. It didn't make any sense at the time, because I had barely even started painting myself, and how was I going to go and really, you know, become an artist? It took me a year and a half to decide to actually do this, so I'm making it sound like it was a quick decision, but it wasn't. But I ended up with some opportunities that worked really well, and one of them was that I was I could get into a self-employment program. So I went into that and sort of explored, like, what could I actually be an artist? Could I pull this off? And because of my extensive teaching background, I found I was able to create these courses that really people were really able to connect with, and I just decided at one point, I was very scared. I had all kinds of things to work through, but I had a lot of community support and family support. I mean, when I announced to people that I was going to become an artist, here we are, a young child, my husband's hurt, I need to be caretaker for both of them, have flexible work, and I announced to people, so many people just said, are you crazy? Like, are you the one with the head injury? Like, they just thought I had lost it, and mm-hmm. But I knew in my gut that this, I couldn't not do it. For some reason, there was this thing that I couldn't not do. So the long story short is I did anything and everything I could to earn money. I was the sole income earner for my family for 5 years. And Patrick was told he would never recover, but we took the settlement money and spent most of it getting him better. So after about 5 or 6 years, he started getting better, and he now works full time and has made a 95% recovery. So we have three daughters. He works full time, and I am now doing my life's work. I'm doing what I need to be doing between the teaching and the painting, and being a mom and having a family. This is why I'm here.
Well. Now, can you describe some of your artwork? What kind of artwork do you do? Just to give brief outlines. Yeah,
I mean, because of my training, I definitely, my work is reminiscent of the old masters. So, you know, Vermeer, Velasquez, Rembrandt, I so many artists I love, Mary Cassatt, and many modern painters, too. So what I paint right now with the philosophical paintings, and I call them philosophical paintings. I'll get into why later, but really what they're about is the human condition and what it means to be a human being and sort of what we go through and what our journeys are about. And so I like to, although I, you know, when you go to Europe and you see depictions of scenes from the Bible or from Greek myth, or and they tell a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mine are very much similar in that sense that they tell a story. They have a similar feel, yet I include modern either concepts or a more contemporary approach to the painting style. So people can see on my website, which is simply lalitahamill.com. They can see. I also paint landscapes, and I specialize in figures and portraits and that sort of thing. But I guess to summarize, it's classical with a modern twist.
Now, what kind of medium do you use in your paint? Is it watercolors or oil-based?
I started out in watercolors, and then I went to oils, and then I went to acrylics, and now I'm back to oils. Oils are my true medium of choice. But I can paint. I can use many, and in fact, when I teach, I often run courses where people can use any medium because I'm versatile that way. But really, in my heart of hearts, I'm an oil painter.
Oh, that's great!
Yeah.
Do you do other forms of art, like sculpturing, or?
I paint abstracts. Oddly enough, I don't have them on my website, but I haven't yet tried sculpture. Although I am planning to do sculpture because. Especially with figurative work, it can be very helpful to really see it three-dimensionally and then render it in paint three-dimensionally. As far as other artwork, I see a lot of integration and crossover between my paintings and my music. I'm a musician, just a hobby musician, but I love to play piano and sing, and writing. So those are sort of my three main, what you would call, artistic endeavors.
Mm-hmm. You had actually mentioned writing. What do you predominantly write?
I write on my blog, which is not very formal, but I tell a lot of my stories on my blog. I'm actually working. I've written a children's book and illustrated a children's book, which is pending publication. I am writing a novel. just for fun. It's about my own family history. And I'm only a couple of chapters in, I'm probably, like they often say, you know, write a novel and then throw that one away and then write another one. So that novel's probably going to take me some time, but I do it because I love it.
Right. And then just before we go into the next segment, you do a lot of public speaking as well.
Mm.
Is this primarily to other budding artists or people who want to take that leap of faith and become an entrepreneur and going after their passions?
It's both. My long story, but my recent newfound passion is around creativity. And so I'm going to be teaching at the University of the Fraser Valley this summer, teaching teachers about how to teach and facilitate, is a better word than teach, creativity to children. And so it's not just kids, though. There are so many adults who are, you know, feeling like they're either stuck. They're stuck in some way. They're not moving. They're stuck either in a job or a relationship, or they're stuck some way and they want to move out of it. And I absolutely love helping people through that process because I've been through it. There's not just one way to go through it, but there are definitely, here's where my philosophy comes in, is I know how to ask questions. So I can ask right. people questions that help them peel back the layers of their onion, as it were.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break from now to hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk to Lalita about her amazing experience in China. We'll be right back.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show, and today we're talking to Lalita Hamill. She's artist, philosopher, writer, and an educator located in British Columbia, Canada. Lalita, you've had some quite amazing experiences regarding your career path as an artist, including a trip to China, which you've never been to before. So can you tell us about your experiences on this special visit?
Absolutely. I blogged about it because when I came home there was just so much to say. It was such an incredible experience. And it all started with me being invited as one of 12 Western Canadian artists to participate in an artist exchange. And so, excuse me, it was to Guiyang, China, which is in central China in a sort of more tropical area. And I didn't know anything about China at all. In fact, it wasn't on my radar as far as places to go. But the opportunity came, and we were told there was going to be an exhibition as well as this exchange, and I was looking around at my artwork going, what do I bring? And a long story short is I decided to bring a very large painting, 4 feet by 6 feet, and it was my first philosophical painting, and it was of Plato's cave allegory. And I had no idea how people in China were going to respond to this painting. I had a sense of how people responded to it here because I'd already had a show with it in the show. And so it's Western philosophy, and Plato is a philosopher who was around at a similar time to some of the key Eastern philosophers, Lao Tzu and Confucius. And the painting is of, I'll briefly describe the allegory. And people, when they see the painting and hear this description, it'll make a bit more sense. But basically, Plato said that it was very similar to the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell talks about, and really it's about enlightenment. What Plato was looking for was a way to educate people so that they could become good leaders for the country. So that's the political side of it. And he described, the metaphor is that we're all inside this cave, okay, and we're sitting there and we've been chained since birth and all we can look at is this wall. And on the wall, going across the wall, are a bunch of silhouettes, shadows, and the shadows are moving and making noise and talking, and that's what we see as being daily life. Anyone who's seen the movie The Matrix can sort of see the similarities here. And Plato said, at some point, one person will suddenly just have this urge to turn their head, where everyone else is transfixed by what's on the wall. And when this one person turns their head, they will see behind them that there's actually another light source, which turns out to be a fire. It's a fire in the cave. And that light source is behind, when you make silhouette puppets on a tent or something?
Oh, I remember those days.
Yeah, yeah, making little silhouettes so the light is shining and your hand is causing the shadow on the wall. Well, there are a bunch of people going back and forth, holding up these things, you know, like a tree and a horse, and all these things go by, basically creating these on the, these silhouettes on the wall. And this person, when they turn, it's painful, right? Because looking into light, when you've been looking, you've been in a dark room and you suddenly come into bright light, it hurts. And that's sort of representative of the truth hurting, right? A new level of truth. And so the person then turns, but as their eyes adjust, they start to see more of the cave and they get a sense of what's actually going on in the cave and that everybody is chained there and they can't move and they're stuck. And then as their eyes adjust some more, and Plato saw this as the philosopher king. I won't get into that. I think it could be anyone who's enlightened, and we have plenty of, you know, examples of people who have gone through this process. Plato would have thought that Socrates was one person who went through this. So they start to understand truth on a deeper level, and these people then are able to see that there's an exit out of the cave up to, and all they can see is bright light shining in through the cave opening. So they climb up and out of the cave, and that's what my first painting is of a bunch of people sitting and staring at the wall. They're bathed in blue, cool blue light, like the light of a television. And there's a woman on the ground who is shielding herself from the fire because it's really bright. And there's one, it happens to be a man, who's pointing towards the cave opening because he's already been out and has come back in. So the second painting I'm doing right now is, the next version is the philosopher coming, or whoever it is, coming out of the cave, and it happens to be the woman who is on the ground. So I've brought her out of the cave, and now she goes through the next three stages of enlightenment, coming out of the cave, and then the third painting in the series will be her coming back down into the cave. And Plato talked a lot about the obligation that someone has once they've been enlightened to come back down into the cave, as it were, and start turning people's heads. So that's the role of, you know, perhaps facilitators or anybody, anybody who can help people grow, et cetera. And I certainly have not gone through the enlightened. I'm not enlightened. But I think there are many people who are seeking truth, and this is just a visual depiction. I did this painting so that people who aren't going to sit down and read Plato, just like people wouldn't be reading the Bible hundreds of years ago because they couldn't read, but now mostly people aren't sitting down and reading philosophy. What they can do is look at it, understand it just from a visual standpoint, and then talk about it. Because everything that Plato said, everything that all of the philosophers have said, Eastern, Western, whoever, all about what it means to be human, and it all applies nowadays, almost more than ever. And so me being able to depict all of this visually for people, it just means that it becomes more accessible.
So what was the reaction of the people in China when they actually saw this painting?
Yeah, it was incredible. I had no idea what to expect. In fact, I was a bit nervous. I didn't know if Plato perhaps had said something that would not be accepted in the East. I really didn't know. I was quite naive at that point. So when we were there and the painting was up on the wall, we had a grand opening. So this was at the Art Museum of Guiyang. It's a enormous city, small by their standards, but enormous city. And I remember one man in particular. There were many interactions. I had some with some teenagers that were incredible, too. They spoke English. This man didn't speak English, and I don't speak Mandarin. And he was standing in front of my painting. And when people look at artwork, I tend to sort of step back because I want people just to be able to engage with the piece. And often when I paint, I try to just create enough of the story. It's just like storytelling where you don't put too much in. Create enough of the story that people can, the viewer can then bring their themselves to the work, and we sort of meet in that, at the painting, right? And so he was standing there, and he was visibly moved. I mean, he almost had tears coming out of his eyes. His whole body posture. And finally, I tracked down one of the other artists who had come along on this exchange who could translate. And I found out through her that he had this incredible story to tell about being a kid in the outskirts of China, feeling oppressed, feeling like he couldn't be himself, and he had to turn away. And his whole description of what happened for him in his life was exactly what was depicted in the painting, but we didn't even have to mention Plato. Do you know what I mean? It was the, I've since found out that this, what happened in Plato, who he was, you know, alive even before Jesus. So he was saying things that resonate with all of us, and it's the hero's journey. It's what Joseph Campbell talks about. We all go through this journey where there's a separation from what we once knew, and then there's a calling to go and do something, and then there's a return back with the story and sharing that story.
Wow. Yeah. Now, you had some pretty other amazing experiences in China. So if you can talk about some of those. And then, because this was an exchange, you also had, there was also 12 Chinese artists that came to Canada. So let's hear a little bit more about some of the other experiences that you had while you were in China.
Absolutely. There were so many. One that stands out is when the opening ceremony, we were, all these things were happening so quickly while we were there. We were just going from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. And the opening ceremony was very grand. I mean, it was literally red carpet, et cetera. Not something you typically see here for artists. And I learned while I was there that not all artists, but certain artists are revered. It's considered quite an honorable profession. And so when we were at this opening, you know, there were media all over, et cetera, and there were these models who had been brought in to escort us down the red carpet. And before we were going to do that, we were asked to paint on the models. So we used this body paint on the models, with just making it up out of our head, which I don't typically do that. I'm an artist. I tend to look at something. I'm gradually able to make things up. So I painted cherry blossoms all over my model, and she was ecstatic about it. She wanted it to be beautiful, and of course, I mean, she looked beautiful, but it just, cherry blossoms just seemed to fit. It fit the theme, and so she had cherry blossoms painted. So I have a photo of me painting cherry blossoms right on her body.
And then you had some artists, 12 Chinese artists, did the exchange, and how was that?
So when they came here, they got the Canadian experience. So when we went there, it was very high. I mean, 5-star, right? When they came here, it was a little more down to earth. And but I think they had a good time anyway. They got to do, for example, they were here over Easter, so they got to experience an Easter egg hunt outside, going and finding Easter eggs outside, which was great fun. But another thing we did that was fun was a community mural project.
Yeah.
So this whole exchange was organized, by the way, through the Burnaby Arts Guild, which did an incredible job. Roseanne Tiernan is one person who was key. And the Burnaby Hospital, we'd created, so I designed a mural for the Burnaby Hospital. And what it was is it was made up of 5x7 small canvases, the whole thing. So we're talking it's 6 feet by 8 feet, all made up of these little tiny tiles. And what I did was I painted all of the, along with some of my neighbors who helped me out, painted all of the tiles with the design. And then we took it all apart, and these tiles were given to members of the public as well as the artists who came from China to paint whatever they wanted on it as long as they just stuck within sort of the color scheme. And it ended up being this incredible mural that got put up at the Burnaby Hospital.
Wow.
So.
And how long did that take? We've got about 10 seconds.
Okay. Well, my end of it was about 60 hours. And then it took an afternoon for people from the community to paint all the tiles. And then reassembly after took more time.
Wonderful. Okay, so we'll be back after these short messages from our sponsors, and we'll be talking more to Lalita and also accessibility to art. So we'll be right back.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live.
And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
When four members of Congress all die within 4 months, each of their deaths appears to be from natural causes. But when mysterious messages begin to appear in the form of quotations from long-dead revolutionary heroes, one reporter sets out to prove the existence of a serial killer. His search discovers dark secrets and an assassin shielded by people who need the very services that only he can provide. The Sun Silas Rising, a novel by Doug Dahlgren. On Kindle or paperback through Amazon.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
You are listening to The Cool Project Show, and I'd like to thank Lalita for coming to the show to talk about her experiences in regards to her artwork and as being a writer and also being as an educator. So, art is everywhere, and I'd like to talk to you about the accessibility of art and give me some ideas of what it is that you do and your opinions on the accessibility of art.
Sure. Well, there's a difference between art that is done for commercial purposes versus art that's non-commercial. So that would be sort of anything that could be considered public art, something that's right out in the open, or perhaps even art that is accessible through galleries or in cathedrals, etc. And so the commercial art end of it is more like the commercial galleries. So I have, that's one example. I have a gallery that represents my work, Gallery 204. And then there's also online. Now, online is definitely growing. There are quite a few artists who are selling work through Facebook, through making connections online. And then, of course, there's Cool Projects, which I like because it actually shows the step-by-step process. So when you see artwork online, typically you just see the work. You might see a little tiny write-up, if you're lucky, about the artwork. But usually it's only the finished piece, whereas, you know, getting to see the story as it progresses and what the person did to create whatever it is they've created, to me, just adds so much more meaning. But I'll get back to that in a second. Accessibility to art, you know, in Vancouver anyway, I mean, I've traveled around the world. I've been, you know, many places in Europe. And when I come home to Vancouver, I always sort of feel like I'm starving a little bit. It's you know, I go to Europe and they're, the architecture, that just the history, right? Just there's so much more history and time for things to have been built and done well, et cetera. And we're still kind of new and green here, as it were. And so art is in I remember it, my husband's Dutch, and he grew up in Holland. And, you know, in Holland, we've met people who save up their money every month in order to go and buy an original oil painting. You know, and the numbers here are fewer, I think. I mean, I don't know per capita what the difference is, but I would like to see art in general, and I don't just mean visual art. I mean all the arts. I mean music, dance, everything, anything around creativity that helps creativity, which is business as well, be sort of more accessible. And I'll leave it at that, but I'll transition later into talking about how it can be accessible to kids especially.
Yeah. And I sort of resonate with what you're saying. I have traveled around the world, and I'm finding more and more art and creativity is fading, especially in a lot of ways with our architecture. A lot of the buildings, beautiful old buildings, are being torn down, and new ones are going up, but they're very bland or very much cookie cut. Can you give me a little bit of your take on that? And this is only my personal view, but do you have that sense as well?
I do in certain places. I mean, I think our attention to quality, it might be disappearing just a little bit. There's sort of a discord. It seems to me like in the education system, there's a definite shift towards, you know, getting creativity going. And that's a whole other discussion, but one that I think is really, really important. Because creativity is going to be, like, not only how we survive and how we thrive, but it provides meaning for a lot of people and expressing ourselves and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, there's a simple element just of beauty, you know, where when you're in a place where it feels good and it's beautiful and lush and vibrant and alive, it just feeds our soul in a way where if we're in a place that just, you know, is busy or whatever your version is, mine happens to be busyness. I don't like really busy, chaotic places. I like to have some peace and quiet. And the architecture, certainly in Langley, which is where I live, is pretty cookie cutter, you know, and going for high prices for the cookie cutter nature that it's in. So there's an element of art really could be accessible right now because we have the internet. Like people can't necessarily see that art in person, but at least they can get a taste online and then even go somewhere. Like I'd love to go to New York and take a look at things in person because seeing a visual work of art anyway in person is very different than seeing it online. So there's sort of that double edge. And then also globally, right? We're exposed globally now. I can go online and find pretty much anything from other countries. So there's a lot more cross-cultural stuff happening, which I think is really exciting and can open us up to new ways of seeing things and expanding and growing and becoming better people. So that's just my take on it. But I think the more we make art accessible locally so that kids can, like, literally go and go on a class tour of a museum and at least get the conversations going. And some kids will be interested in it, some won't. And others can do sports. There's creativity in sports, too. It's everywhere. So, yeah, that's accessibility online is fabulous. I just think we need to remember why we're doing what we're doing.
Right.
Whatever that is, whatever people like to do, just remember why we're doing it.
Right. During the commercial break, you and I were actually talking about art and art for fundraising. And mm-hmm. both you and I have a passion with the Cystic Fibrosis Society. And mm-hmm. I actually hadn't realized you had participated. You were one of the first artists to participate in their fundraising, which has become an internationally acclaimed program. So can you tell us a little bit about art and fundraising and the example with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation?
Absolutely. I mean, as an artist, I get calls all the time asking me to donate my artwork, you know, either for silent auctions or for whatever. And I've donated to the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, and I have a bunch of places, and the Federation of Canadian Artists. And, you know, there are a lot of places that I do donate, and I donate time as well. And it's something that I can do to help, it sounds cliche, but help make the world a better place. And the 65 Red Roses was something that started here in Vancouver because Ava Markvoort, who is the young woman who had cystic fibrosis, a documentary was made of her called 65 Red Roses. And I didn't know about it until I was contacted to be one of the Canadian artists, one of 65 artists invited, along with Robert Bateman and a bunch of others, to paint one red rose. And all of these roses were put together and made into a mural, which now hangs at the Children's Hospital in Vancouver. And when I went to the event, I met the father and the family of Ava Markvoort, and was really taken with their story. And even though, I mean, cystic fibrosis has never impacted anybody that I've known before, there was just something that really resonated for me. Anyway, to make a long story short, I connected with the family. I did paintings of Ava and her sister and brother and their parents and everything. And part of the story for 65 Red Roses is that kids who have cystic fibrosis Often it's a difficult thing to say, cystic fibrosis, and it's a disease of the lungs. I don't know if people can look it up if they want, if they're interested. Just type in 65 red roses and you'll find it. It's on, it's been picked up by Oprah's network. But they have a hard time saying cystic fibrosis, and so they'll often say 65 roses. Now, Ava Markvoort loved the color red. She would color her hair red, and so that's why this whole thing was called 65 Red Roses. I don't want to give any spoiler alerts in case people, you know, haven't seen it, so I'm not saying much more other than it's an incredibly moving story and an incredibly wonderful way to contribute to people who need help. Yeah, and art events and all of these things can really, it's like they're win-win-win situations. They can bring people together. They can raise money for charities. They can help people connect with each other, establish relationships. Every time I've been involved in something like this, it's been a win-win-win situation, and I love participating in it.
Yes, and it's a good cause as well, with the auctions. Now, that's one way that you've actually marketed yourself in an indirect way, because it is for fundraising. But how do you market yourself and your work? We've talked about, the galleries. How do you get into the galleries?
Well, I stayed out of galleries for quite some time, mostly out of my own sort of fears about being able to supply the gallery and all that kind of stuff. And I'm still not there. I would like to be. I'm transitioning out of that. But there's, most of it for me so far has been because of just connecting with people. And some of it's online. But it's all been through building relationships to this point. Even though something is sitting online, it's like a book. If you read a really good book, you can sometimes sort of feel a connection to the author, even if you don't know the author of the book. That's what happens for me anyway. There's a connection, a meeting place with the book. And I think that happens with paintings too. And whether or not that connection is ever sort of, that circle is ever completed, I may not meet people. There's a building of relationship on many, many different levels. And the work doesn't always speak for itself. And sometimes the quote-unquote marketing, like when I took the self-employment program years and years and years ago, I was absolutely terrified of having the idea of having to do marketing and networking. I'm an introvert.
Yeah, what is the self-employment program? So many people may not know what that is.
Oh, okay. It's a program that existed where anyone who has been on sort of maternity leave, et cetera, and wants to start up their own business. The YMCA here in town runs one as well, but they can go and basically get 10 months of training and some funding and help launch their business, basically. So anybody who hasn't had a business background, I was in a bit of business with the rec center, but I really didn't have much of a business background. And so when I went through that, I, like I said, was absolutely terrified of the idea of marketing. And a lot of people are. A lot of people who would be great business people think, oh, I can't do this because I don't know how to network. I don't know how to talk to people or whatever their reason is. I knew how to talk to people, but I just felt like I didn't want to be like, when you go into a store and there's someone who basically just rushes at you and just starts, telling you all the things you need to buy and why you need this and just overwhelming. That was what I had in mind as far as selling. So
right.
That was my own limitations.
Yeah. Now, we're going to be segueing in a minute for the last segment, but
right.
Just briefly, how do you value, we'll talk about it when we come back, but think about how do you do your pricing for your artwork and marketing the pricing and the where people will say, I'm willing to pay that much money or it's too expensive.
Yes.
So coming right back up in our last segment, we'll continue our talk with Lalita Hamill, and we'll talk about the pricing of artwork and her vision for artists and art and why art is so important. We'll be right back.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
When four members of Congress all die within 4 months, each of their deaths appears to be from natural causes. But when mysterious messages begin to appear in the form of quotations from long-dead revolutionary heroes, one reporter sets out to prove the existence of a serial killer. His search discovers dark secrets and an assassin shielded by people who need the very services that only he can provide. The Sun Silas Rising, a novel by Doug Dahlgren, on Kindle or paperback through Amazon.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show. And with us we have Lalita Hamill. Lalita, we have covered a lot in this show, including your life-changing car accident that had been the catalyst for you to become a professional artist. We've also covered your experiences in a cultural exchange in China and also your successes as a professional artist. Now, just before the break, we were talking about pricing. So can you tell me a little bit more about how do you value your artwork and the pricing process that you do?
Sure, absolutely. It's a very practical thing and very important for anyone who's in the industry, quite frankly, and whether that's someone who wants to buy a piece of art or an artist who's wanting to sell something. So there's the obvious stuff to take into account. And the first thing is artists need to remember that we are business people. We are self-employed business people. And so we have a product, and our heart is in the product usually. So there are the supplies, there's the time, there are expenses, there are taxes. There are all those things to take into consideration, but, you know, if someone's a really slow painter, it doesn't mean that they can charge more for their work. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. There's market value, and that sort of key is what's your positioning within the market? Where are you at? Can you sell out of a gallery? Can you sell your own work online? And what do you charge? I once broke everything down where I said, okay, if I have this painting that's for sale for $2,000, it's framed, it's in a gallery, how much do I get in my pocket from that painting? And after the supplies and expenses and taxes and the gallery taking 50%, in my pocket, which would pay for my time, would be $550 from a $2,000 painting. So that just gives people an idea of how much an artist is receiving, unless you're buying directly from the artist, depending on whether or not they have galleries. So, you know, the people who decide how much something is going to go for, it really depends on whether it's someone who's selling their work at a local art show, or if it's in a high-end gallery, or if it's in a curated show, etc. So it has to do with economy, right? What are people willing to pay? How much disposable income do people have? And one thing that people can remember, I think, is that art is actually an incredible investment. You know, a lot of people in China are buying up art, North American art specifically, because they see it as an investment. You know, there are many people through history there's a couple in Canada who collected art over the years simply because they loved it. They loved the work. And they ended up amassing an incredible collection, which they donated to a museum. But in this time and age when people are looking for places to invest money, if you do your research, just like if you're going to invest online and you do research into the companies, you know, the CEO and everything else, do research into the artist. Find out what their vision is. Find out how many hours they paint every week. Find out where they plan on going. And you know, if you spend $5,000 now on a painting, you know, if that artist is really working hard at it and is going for it, that painting could be worth a lot more than that in 10 years. So, anyway, I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but that's that's pricing and market value for paintings.
Mm. So, then briefly, how do you talk about your artistic process in creating, you know, these pieces that you are doing?
Right. So it varies. It depends on it, whether it's a, you know, 4 foot by 6 foot philosophical painting versus, you know, a painting of a rose. And I you know, they have equal value. It's just that the philosophical paintings are a much more extensive process and much more of a challenge, which I love. So in general, there's preparation, and anyone who owns a business or most people will identify with this process. You sort of have preparation where you learn what you need to learn. You get your ducks in a row. You know, you incubate for a little idea for a little while. You let the ideas sort of percolate and settle, and then have that eureka moment of like, oh, I know what I want to do. And then here comes the crunch, is the implementation. A lot of people do the preparation, incubation, and sort of get the illumination, that eureka moment, but then don't do anything with it. Or self-doubt comes in and they squash it, or they, you know, focusing on practical things that often do get in the way, but the key is which things are actually getting in the way. So then there's the implementation, which is can be a very long process. And then there's the evaluation, which happens all the way through, where I will constantly be evaluating. So when I paint, my goal is that my left brain will not be participating in the process at all. So I've done all my preparatory work beforehand, but that's not to say that it won't change as I go along. It's just I want total freedom when I'm painting. So I've sorted out with a composition where my subjects are going to be, where this tree is going to be, where that's going to be, what the colors are, and all of that. And then I start to paint, and then I just, you know, go with the flow. And when it's really on, it's incredible. It's absolutely amazing. It doesn't happen all the time, but when it does happen, it's amazing. So then there's the evaluation, and there's this push-pull. You know, people often think that, oh, it must be so wonderful to be an artist. It's actually quite heart-wrenching sometimes and very, very difficult to do, and takes a lot of courage. You know, you've got to kind of leave your ego at the door, be willing to take risks, basically say, okay, I'm afraid of this. I'm afraid of, I've been in painting competitions, for example, Battle of the Brush, where you go up there and you're just painting in front of a crowd, and you got to just kind of let it go and just trust that you're going to either pull something off or you're not in that kind of situation. So right. My artistic process is one where I really flip back and forth. I draw on my training, my philosophical training and sort of left brain analytical stuff, and then I draw on my creative side, and the blend of those two is really what I'm going for in every piece that I do.
Jen, what is your vision, you know, as a teacher and also as an artist?
Right. Well, you know, it took me 10 years to boil down why I paint. And here's my artist statement, because it summarizes it the best. It's I paint and teach to gently awaken in myself and others that which has been lost, hidden, or buried. And the reason I'm saying this is that I think we're born sort of with a knowledge of who we are, and then layers of things happen, and we can forget that. And, you know, I've met many successful people who, by all accounts, in our society are successful. They have money, they've got, you know, cars, they know a lot of people, they're doing everything right, and they still feel like there's something missing. There's something missing from themselves. There's sort of this hole that hasn't been filled. And when we talk about creativity, and creativity isn't just with the arts, it is all over the map. It could be horse riding, it could be anything. When people tap into that creativity, they fill that hole. You know, they can fill that gap. And so as a teacher, and I actually prefer in some ways the word facilitator. When I go into large groups and I'm there as a facilitator, I ask questions. I get people to dig really, really deep. And, you know, there's a book I'd like to mention, because I mention it often when I'm teaching. if you don't mind. It's called Life Purpose Boot Camp, and it's by Dr. Eric Maisel. I could put a link up, I guess, on there, but it's M-A-I-S-E-L. He's written a lot of books, but the Life Purpose Boot Camp gets you to sit down and really think about the kinds of things you like to do and are meaningful for you. Because it's one thing to say, you know, the way to be more creative is to drive to work a different way or wear different clothes or do things differently, but that just scratches the surface. Yeah. And we're all so different that what creativity means to me is likely going to be a bit different than what it means to other people.
Right. So yeah. We do know that art is important, but give me some insight as to why you think art is important.
Okay, well, the first and foremost thing that comes to mind for me is, you know, imagine walking into a gallery. Let's talk about visual art first. There are many different art forms, music and such, but you walk into a gallery, if you like visual art or even if you don't, you sit down and you're looking at a painting. You can't help but just be with yourself. You know, so there's almost this enforced calm reflection, enforced if for some people it feels uncomfortable, right, because we're not used to having those quiet moments away where we're surrounded by things that are binging and colorful sights and promotions and all kinds of stuff all the time, busy, 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 busy. And so what art can do is get you to just sit down, be reflective, and have an oasis. If it's a beautiful landscape, you can just sort of sit and daydream like a kid would do. So there's that part of it, just slowing things down and being present. And then there's a difference between people doing art themselves versus observing art. You know, so observing art, you can be, you know, looking at somebody else's painting and feeling it and wondering about the story and seeing the world in a different way. And it's great because the arts in general, so music, dance, visual art, they're universal. It's a universal language. You don't need to speak the language in order to understand what's happening. Sometimes it's helpful to have a bit of history, but other than that, you know, it fosters cultural appreciation and awareness of other cultures and can cross over economic, social, racial, economic barriers. And as long as art is accessible to people, all of this can happen. And then there's doing art. So like if you're actively involved or if kids are involved in doing art, it promotes collaboration. It helps kids with their academic achievement. You know, kids enjoy learning. Adults enjoy learning. They want to pay attention. They can they have to make all kinds of decisions and learn how to make decisions and get their confidence going and all these great things. I mean, I did an art as therapy. Like, I taught a brain injury group for 7 years. These were people who had adults who had sustained pretty substantial injuries. And I don't know if I have time to tell the story of one woman who you can stop me if I don't. But there was one woman there who had suffered an incredible stroke. She couldn't speak. But her eyes were alive, you know, when someone has sparkling eyes. And she started painting, and she was doing these things and these amazing geometric designs and layering color and all of that. And every time she came, she was just engaged. And I found out after she left the group that she was Canada's first female engineer. So this is a very bright woman who had lost her ability to speak and communicate. But the interactions we had through the paintings and through just her eyes, it's something I'll never forget. It was really meaningful.
Right.
So that's an example of one person where art helped her express herself when she couldn't do it with words.
Well, this is going to be a wrap-up for our show, and I really want to say a big thank you for Lolita Hamill. You can go to her website, www.lolitahamill.com. Again, Lolita, thank you so much for coming to our show. If you'd like to contact Lolita or if you would like to contact Cool Projects, we want to hear about you and what projects that you may have that we can have on this show. That would be great. You can email us at coolprojects@americaswebradio.com. Have a great week, everyone, and thank you for listening to the show.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.